Welcome to Path to Cytoscan, the podcast for developers who love Postgres, where we discuss the human side of open source databases, Postgres, and the PG extensions. Thank you to the team at Microsoft for sponsoring this community conversation about Postgres. I'm Claire Giordano, and today's topic is all about my journey to explaining Explain. And I am so excited to introduce Michael Christofides, who is the founder of PG Mustard, a Postgres company based in the UK, and he's also co-host of a great podcast called Postgres FM. Michael has worked in, around, and with Postgres for 7 years. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Claire, that's kind of you. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. All right, let's dive in. I have so many questions for you about how you got into Postgres and why you founded a Postgres company, what you do. And of course, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast too. You are, believe it or not, the first podcast host that we have had as a guest on the show. So I'm a tiny bit nervous. You might be judging me.
Oh, absolutely not. I know how difficult it is. And as a loyal listener of yours, I've told you in the past, I've listened to every episode. I wish there were more podcasts, more Postgres podcasts specifically out there. So, you'll only ever get encouragement from me.
Thank you. And I love hearing from people when they say that I've listened to every episode. We're here to talk about you, but remind me later in the show, if you can, to tell you a story of something that happened at PG Day Chicago last week. But let's go there later. I want to start with you. So I thought we would start with your very first encounter with Postgres. Like, when was that? What were you doing? Ooh. And how did you get started with it? Do you remember?
Good question.
Or do you think you've known about it since you were two?
Definitely not. That might be around when Postgres started, definitely not that early. I was out of university or college. I'll try and Americanize my answers. I worked at a company called Redgate. Well, about 6 months after graduating, I ended up working at a company called Redgate, who made tools for developers and database administrators, but mostly for Microsoft SQL Server, or SQL Server, as it's often called. And as part of that, we had customers who wanted the same. They would quite often ask, do you do this same product but for Oracle, would be the normal question. Do you do this same product but for MySQL? And this was back in, when would this have been? 2010, early 2010.
Okay.
But it probably wasn't until like a year in that I started hearing Postgres crop up, you know, people starting to ask. I started to become aware of it, basically. And I think that's not a coincidence. I do think that was roughly when it was starting to be a little bit more mainstream. People were, including SQL Server customers, were considering putting new projects on Postgres. There were definite business cases for doing so. The features were catching up enterprise-wise. So I don't think it's an accident. And then that got put on kind of extreme mode for me, because I ended up running the team that we had internally that were porting some of our most successful products over to Oracle, like to support Oracle. And we also adopted a couple of tools for MySQL as well. So our little small team, you know, in a company of 300, our little team of about 8 or 9 were running these products for Oracle and MySQL. So we were the natural place for people to come and ask, are we going to make a Postgres version? Can we make a Postgres version? Should we? That kind of thing. And I was never successful in my endeavors to make that business case. But that's when I first started coming across Postgres, was in my 5 years there. And then when I left Redgate, which was based in Cambridge, UK, and moved to London, and I worked at a startup called GoCardless. And they, a payments company, it was quite early days for them back then, late 2014. And they ran Postgres in production at quite a decent scale by then, but not like nothing compared to what they are now. And the team loved it. They were really kind of, they used to blog about it. That was infectious. That really rubbed off on me. And that was when I realized it wasn't just large companies moving workloads over to Postgres for cost reasons. It was also startups choosing it because the technology was great, and choosing it over MySQL for a bunch of reasons. But that was when I thought, you know what, this is a cool product, cool platform. Very, very open community, very, very giving community, lots of positives, a place that I'd like to be long term, basically.
Yeah, it's really interesting, this idea that people can love a database. Before I got into the space, I wouldn't have believed it if you told me that. Because, you know, it's a database. It's just a database. There's lots of databases. What's to love? But people who work in or use Postgres, a lot of them love it. And you use the word love. So that's why I'm riffing off of that.
It's a good point. I think there is something to that. And it's partly another reason I chose to make products for Postgres is because the people using it tend to love their jobs. And that might sound, I guess most of our audience are in like a technical. So a lot of them will also have chosen this as a career and will love what they do. But lots of people out there in the world don't love their jobs. And I have worked at businesses where we're serving customers that don't love their jobs. And it isn't as rewarding. You don't get the same feedback. You don't get the same, you know, if you do something great, you don't get quite as much positivity. But if you do something bad, you don't get quite as much anger. So you can't, I love that though. I love being held to that high standard. And I think I really enjoy impressing people that hold you to high standards. I find a lot of like satisfaction in that. And it is a love hate thing. And I think the database thing is also, you can see it from the flip side. I think a lot of people that love Postgres have had previous experiences with databases that they, let's say, do not love. for one reason or another. So I think there's also a nice, like, it's easy to love something if you've had previous experience of something that didn't treat you so well.
I had this teacher in high school. It was just crazy. I do not remember most of my high school teachers' names, but I remember his. It was Mr. Blanchard, and he wore a bow tie every day to school to teach. And he was very fond of saying that his vocation and his avocation were one and the same. And that was his wish for all of his students. And many people don't get that in life. Like you said, they don't love their job. How they earn their living and what they like to do are not one and the same, right? And anyway, that always stuck with me, that desire to have meaningful work that I could both enjoy as something to do, but also be the way I make my living. So it's kind of a nice thing when you have it.
And absolutely.
I do think you're right. I think a lot of people in the Postgres world do have it, which is kind of cool. Okay. So you studied mathematics in college. That was do you call it a major? No, you don't. What do you call it in where you went to university?
Yeah, good research. We do have joint degrees sometimes, but they're more the exception rather than the rule. So we tend to just go to university to study one subject, and we can take some classes in other related or sometimes unrelated subjects, but it's more common just to only study one subject start to finish.
Okay, so mathematics is what you focused on. And I guess my curiosity is, were any computer science classes part of that field of study for you?
Yeah, yes. Not really is the honest answer. We had to do like basics of, so the first year, I don't think we got much choice at all. It was a bit of pure maths, a little bit of statistics, and a little bit of mechanics. And I think in the second year, I did some statistics that involved a little bit of programming, MATLAB type thing. So there was a little bit, but it wasn't computer science for sure. It was very much a little bit of programming for a very specific goal.
Okay. All right. So really your focus on databases started after you were out of university and when you were at Redgate. So Redgate wasn't just where you first started to learn about Postgres, but it was where you really started to go deep on databases altogether.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. I got very lucky. Like what caught my eye about Redgate was actually their slogan. It was Redgate Software. Oh, no, Redgate Tools at the time, I think it was called. And then it said, ingeniously simple software. Something like, it was one of those ways around. I can't remember if it was Redgate Software, ingeniously simple tools. That actually sounds funny now. Saying it back.
Doesn't that sound better? Redgate Software, ingeniously simple tools. I like that better.
I don't think they, I don't think they're using it anymore, but I fell in love with that as a slogan. I really enjoyed the idea that you could differentiate your product on simplicity. Perhaps it's the mathematician in me, but I love simple, elegant solutions to problems and would sometimes annoy my housemates by throwing away some coursework because I thought I could do it simple. Well, I worked out a way to do it simpler, even though it was done, worked out a way to do it better. And in software, you can be rewarded for that. And it never crossed my mind that that was true until reading that slogan.
Maybe that's why I liked you right away when I met you. You know, there's lots of ways to think about the different attributes that like we humans have and our personalities and in the way we do things. But one of the things I really like is when I meet a kindred spirit who does like to find a way to do it better, who is constantly like in search of excellence or in search of how could we improve? How could we make this more efficient? And doesn't, what's that phrase? We have a phrase in US English, at least, which is like good enough for government work. It's a horrible phrase. Like, what does that say about governments? But I can't stand that attitude of good enough for government work. And so anyway, I love that you threw out coursework and did it simpler. That's great.
Yeah, maybe not the smartest move ever, but yeah.
Well, when you lose sleep, it's probably not the smartest move, right?
Yeah. I did want, before we move too far past it, the way you asked that first question, the first time I ever came across Postgres was super interesting. And I'd be curious on your answer to that one as well.
That's a good question. And I'm not prepared for it.
Sorry.
I think I probably came across Postgres and don't recall and don't remember the first time. There's a German term for that where maybe you've been exposed to something over and over, but you've been blind to it. You've missed it. You haven't retained it. And then all of a sudden it sticks. And then you feel like you're seeing that thing, that word, that term, that everywhere. And there is a wonderful German word for that. And I don't know if anyone in the live text chat knows what that term is. But the first time that I started to go deep, that I started working with Postgres is when I joined Citus Data. So that would have been early 2017. And I actually went through an interesting like 6 month period of having multiple invitations, multiple nudges to go meet the team at Citus, to go interview with the team at Citus. And a couple times I passed. And it was kind of like, you know, I'm not a database person. You know, I'm not sure this is the right space for me. I'm not sure this is the right job. So I didn't go have those discussions. And then, so like the folks at Redmonk, Steve O'Grady I met Craig Kirsteins at a Redmonk event. He's like, you should come talk to us. We have an opportunity. And I didn't follow up on it. And then a month later, Steve O'Grady, one of the founders of Redmonk, which is my favorite like developer analyst firm on the planet, Steve sent me an email and said, I'd like to introduce you. Are you interested? And I passed on that. And then I was, having coffee with Anil Lakhani in downtown Palo Alto at Blue Bottle Cafe, which is a fun little place. And yes, espresso was involved. And he's like, what? You haven't gone to talk to Craig? You haven't gone to Citus? You need to go meet those folks. And so then I reached out and, you know, the rest is history. So what is that?
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. And
8 years or so?
I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I did it. Yeah, seven plus years. Unless my math is an off by one error. Okay, so let's fast forward to the present day. You are the founder of a Postgres company called PG Mustard. So before you tell me about how and why you founded PG Mustard, maybe just give us the elevator answer of what is PG Mustard?
Yeah, sure. So it is a web visualization tool for explain analyze. So that helps people review and Postgres query plans and hopefully speed them up. that's actually the opinionated part of it. It very much assumes you're looking at a query plan because you're trying to speed it up, which is a fair assumption most of the time. But if you're looking at a query plan for any other purpose, it would actually be worse to look at it through PG Mustard.
Okay. And why and how did you found this company?
Oh, good question. And by the way, founder makes it sound like it's perhaps bigger than it is. But so it's mostly just me. I've been working with one other person over the past 5 years, but that person has changed a few times. So it's always been two of us, which is nice. And it's a fun little team. But yeah, so did you say why? I've managed to forget the question.
Why and how, which are two separate questions, yeah. And I combine them, which you're not supposed to do. So I apologize for that. Let's start with why.
Yeah. So I was basically through my career, I'd ended up in product management type roles. I really love product work. I'm very opinionated. Sad to a fault, but also I guess it's definitely a strength at times, and I really like taking ownership and getting things done, and that suited product type work. And at companies, when you're a product manager, you get given a lot of autonomy, but ultimately you can still get overruled. There's always somebody who can say, do you know what? You've got a great team there, but we need them elsewhere. We need two of your developers to go to work on this, your marketing person to go work on that, and here's some replacements. Or they can say, oh, it's nice that you've got these plans, or even in one case, can we double your team size? And when I pushed back, they saw that as a sign that I didn't believe in the vision as much. I wanted to keep going with a smaller team and grow it gradually in some ways you want to keep your team morale and like highly effective teams are hard to just double in size overnight and stay highly effective. So I had some strong opinions, and it didn't always massively align well with working for other people. So eventually I realized I'm going to have to either learn how to get good at this, learn how to manage up better, get better at middle management and politics and all those things, or I'm going to have to do my own thing. And doing my own thing felt more long-term sustainable and enjoyable. So eventually I ended up doing it in a way that I was trying to design my ideal job. So I really loved working in small teams. I really found it really fun. It felt like you were working with a group of friends. You could know everybody really well. You could get a lot done. I'd experienced getting a huge amount done with a small, effective team. And I liked that everyone could have the same goal in a small team. But once you confine yourself to problems that only a small team can solve, you can't go raise money. You can't. It just doesn't make sense. It's not very investable. So I knew I had to self-fund it. I knew self-funding it would be probably more sensible. And then, so it's kind of working backwards. It's not the normal founder story, but I was looking for ideas, problems, markets where a small team could be really successful over many, many years, hopefully decades, solving a problem really well. And Postgres seemed like an ideal ecosystem for that. It had track record. There were small independent companies that had existed for multiple decades, doing great work, contributing back to the community, really valued members of the community. So it felt like a really nice place. And also it wasn't controlled by one corporation who could, you know, there wasn't quite the same platform risk you get if you build for a different platform. So there were so many nice things about it. It really got good vibes off the community, dipped our toe in, started to get to know it, started to explore what tools could be useful. That's what we were good at. We'd built tools in the past. We knew how to make them good. We had opinions anyway, or we thought we did. We thought we knew how to make them good. So yeah, that was kind of like the why. And then the how was gradually going part-time. So going down to 4 days a week, a very, very entrepreneur-friendly employer that I worked at called Savanta. They're a market research firm. And they let me go down to 4 days a week. The idea, they always knew that my plan was to go start my own thing. And they were very, very supportive of that, which was great. So gradually going down, doing research, talking to people, talking to friends that use Postgres, talking to their friends, going online, following IRC, Slack, wherever anybody was asking Postgres questions, I was there looking at what people were asking, what kind of problems they had, what tools they were using, what things they liked, what things they didn't like, that kind of thing.
Very cool. You know, working 4 days a week is an interesting thing. Now, when you went to 4 days a week part-time at your company, though, you were still obviously working the other day because you were trying to incubate and nurture this business idea, this company idea. Is that right?
Yeah, great point. I sometimes described it to friends as I went down from about 5.5 or 6 days a week to 4. And that's because you work at a startup company, you're often working into the evenings bear in mind, I cared too much. I would always be doing probably a bit too much. And that was my general pattern through working for other people. But when I went down to 4 days a week, I had to work out, had to empower my team a little bit more, which is definitely a fault that I hadn't done that as much before. But giving the team frameworks on how to make quick decisions, easy decisions on the day that I'm not there, what frameworks can they use to, like, what would I do? What could they look at? Like, give them access to things, get them closer to customers, that kind of thing. It actually made the rest of the days that I was working there easier as well. So it felt like I went down from working a bit too much to actually I can just work these 4 days. And that meant I could, instead of trying to start PG Mustard evenings and weekends, which I was doing at first, I and also Dave, who I was working with at the time, could both be off on Fridays and do a full day of work on a Friday just on PG Mustard, which was, we loved those days, which was nice.
Very cool. The only time in my life when I've worked 4 days a week, which was for several years, probably for 5 or 6, at least 5 years, was when I had little kids. And when I came back after my first maternity leave, I had to basically interview at Sun for a new job, because when you take a 6-month leave, like, your previous job is kind of gone, right? So you have to go interview for an equivalent thing. So I got two offers, and with both of them, I'm like, look, you can have me 4 days a week, or you can have someone else 5 days a week, but I'm only coming back 4 days a week. And they both picked me. And I picked one of those jobs, and I did that for years. And I was fairly religious about it. Like, I was not online on Fridays. I was not checking my messages or any of that. I was from Thursday night to Monday morning, I was a full-time mom. But then during those 4 days a week, I probably worked 11-hour days or something like that. It was pretty intense. But I took a cut in pay to make sure, like, that there was no expectation that I would be available on a Friday. And it was a nice period of my life. We went to the mountains for a long weekend every weekend.
That's awesome.
So it was kind of cool. Anyway, I wish I always had 4 days a week. It would be a nice lifestyle, I suppose. Okay, people who don't know the answer to this, and I'm one of them, probably wonder this every time they go to their website. Like, why mustard? Like, why is the name PG Mustard? There's got to be a story there.
Yeah, it is a question I get a fair bit, actually. I ended up writing a blog post about it a couple of years ago, and it was quite fun to tell, like, to tell the story. It's not as fun a story as it sounds like it could be, but because we were exploring ideas in the Postgres space before settling on what the product did, we did kind of need a placeholder name, a domain, like a place we could put a website and a you know, place people could drop their email addresses if they wanted to, like, speak to us about anything. So we needed a domain name before we knew what the product did. So partly it needed to not mean anything. Did also, you know, I looked around and it was quite nice that in the Postgres space, a lot of tools started with PG and then a word, which meant you could get away with just a single word name. You could, you know, because single word names are difficult if you ever want to be found on Google, or if somebody recommends it to somebody else, can you actually find the website? So it needed to have all those kind of basics of, you know, unique. Is it easy to say? Is it easy to spell? I'd worked at Go Cardless. I think I mentioned them already, but I also wanted it not to be a negative name. There was Go Cardless didn't do card payments. It did other payments, but it always felt negative to me. Why is it kind of felt aggressive? Why are we telling our customers what to do? So yeah, I wanted something that had positive connotations, and we've also the domain. We wanted the .com, obviously. Everyone always does, don't they? So it was available, and I liked the word and the color, which helped. Mustard is slang for kind of good or awesome or something. If you say that's mustard, it's kind of that's awesome. It's not widely used, but we've got a few words like that in English, like that's mint is one, another one. Considered PG Mint, and, you know, PG Stripes I actually owned for a while. That was probably the second. I think I had pgstripes.com and pgstripes.dev or something like that. So yeah, it could have been any of those. I liked the stripes. I liked the idea of Go Faster Stripes being a performance tool. But mustard, we got lucky that one of my favorite testimonial, actually, I've got to give a shout out to Piotr Adamiak from Oliphant Consulting. He was one of our earliest customers, and he said, I have to say, I find your mustard hot stuff and really user friendly. So it does lend itself to a few puns, which will always make me happy.
That's really cool. So what did Piotr say again? Say it again, please.
He said, I have to find your mustard hot stuff. Okay. So yes, spicy tips or, you know, that kind of thing.
I like it. Hot stuff and with spicy tips. That's very cool. Okay, so the title of this episode today is My Journey to Explaining Explain. I think that we try to reach a lot of people in the Postgres world. I obviously know people who are experts and developers and contributors who listen to the podcast. But I think there's also a category of people who are new to Postgres. Maybe they've worked for years in other databases, but not in Postgres. Or maybe they're just getting started, you know, in their careers or as a developer. And so I don't want to assume that our listeners know what Explain is and what it does. So let's just start there with the basics. Maybe explain
it. Yeah, of course.
Explain it as if you're talking to someone who's, you know, just deciding to study these kinds of things in college. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Early stages.
I'll give it a go, and you can pick me up if I'm pitching it wrong. So explain is a keyword that you can put before a query that you run against the database. And instead of it then running the query, it will instead return a plan, an execution plan of what the database would do to execute your query, to return the results, or, you know, to do whatever you asked it to do. But it won't do it. It will just tell you, here's my plan. That can be really helpful for performance reasons. So for example, if you start running a query and or if you're scared that a query is going to take an hour or be really long or really slow, and you can't handle that, that's not okay. You can put explain in front of your query and just get an idea of what steps is it going to take. Does it think it will be relatively low cost in, you know, is it going to use an index, and does that look fairly cheap? So there's certain information you get back. However, it is like almost a whole nother language. It's in English, but you get it's quite a lot of information, quite densely packed.
So when it is a whole other language, you're talking about the results that you get. So
yeah, the
explain in front of you, the output that you get from an explain. Correct? Yes.
Exactly. So that can be a little bit daunting. So on simple queries, it can be quite short, but on complex queries, it can be, you know, hundreds of lines of text with a lot of statistics, a lot of numbers in there, not all of which tell you exactly what they are or mean. It can be intimidating, and sometimes you'll find in teams that people have kind of different levels of being able to understand them. Some people it's quite common to have multiple people on the team that have no idea how to read them, and maybe like one or two that are good at it, and one that you go to when you have a really gnarly one. And I knew that for development teams, having spoken to a bunch of people. But what I didn't realize until a few years into the journey, speaking to a Postgres consultant, they said that's true even at Postgres consultancies. There are levels to understanding explain, and what we noticed also, that's explain on its own. It will just give you the execution plan but won't run the query. There's an important additional parameter, so you can run explain analyze, and that can be written the English way, the British way, or the American way, which is a fun fact.
And that will... Wait. What do you mean the British way and the American way? Talk to me.
So with an S or with a Z.
Oh, and both work?
Both work, yeah.
I assumed it only works with a Z. I think it should only work with a Z. Sorry, I'm a little biased. No,
that's okay. It makes me happy that it works with an S. And I was very, very happy to present at a London event and use S's everywhere.
Oh, and Rob Treat in the chat says, I think Michael means to say with an S or with a Z.
I made so much effort to say Z.
Oh, well.
He's quite right.
That's quite a nice little tidbit. I didn't know that. Good. I'm glad to. Today I learned.
Yeah.
Explain analyze with an S.
Yeah, it does the same thing, and I haven't said what it does, sorry. It will also execute the query and return execution statistics, which importantly is includes time. So how much time was spent on each stage. So that's not super helpful if your query is going to take an hour. It's going to take you an hour to get those results. But if you if you're going to have to run this query a few times, or, you know, quite often, it could be extremely helpful. And performance work is a lot about understanding why is something slow and looking at the bottlenecks. So explain analyze is what we focused on, and is almost another tool on top of explain. And there are lots of other parameters that are very useful as well, but that's the key one.
Well, and I think if we step back, you did a great job explaining it. I think the fact that you embrace simplicity in so many things you do comes through in the way you talk. Right. And so I love everything about what you said, what you explained. Haha. I think if we step back a little bit, though, like the point I would also make to that 20-year-old or 18-year-old or 16-year-old is that SQL, the language, right, not the Microsoft SQL Server database, but the language itself is a declarative language. And what that means is it's not like some of the other languages where when you're programming, you're basically telling the computer what to do, right? In this case, you're saying, this is the result I want, or this is the question I want answered, correct? And so to that end, you do need something like explain and explain analyze, because when you say, this is what I want to query, you don't know what approach the database is going to take or how optimal it will be, or whether you need to revise your query and ask the question in a slightly different way in order to get you to the answer faster. Does that make sense?
That is a brilliant way of explaining it. Yes, absolutely. It's the best and the worst thing about SQL, right? It handles all of that stuff for us, but it's also opaque unless we look into it. So yes, it has choices, and that can be, if it's got an index on a column that you're filtering on, it has a choice to use that index, or it can still scan the entire table, or it has other scan types that it can choose in certain cases. So scan types are one choice. Join order is another choice. There's all sorts of that. They're probably the two biggest, but yeah, it has lots and lots of different choices it can make, and it's doing so based on a cost model. It's estimating the cost of doing each of these, and it's ultimately picking the plan with the lowest cost. So that's what you get back when you run explain on its own. You get just these arbitrary unit costs, and it will tell you it will only return the cheapest plan that it found with its costs. But to find out what the actual performance is, and what you need to run it with analyze, and that will always be the same plan as when you run it with explain, with some slight exceptions around how many parallel workers it chooses and things like that. So like some slight execution related differences, but yeah, it'll always be the same query plan, but now with the actual timings is the obvious one, but also if you include other parameters like buffers is probably the next most important, or definitely the next most important. That it will also tell you the amount of data being read, for example.
40 minutes into the episode, when Michael Christofides of PG Mustard first brings up the topic of buffers, I'm impressed. Like I'm surprised you lasted that long, because you are well known for your opinions. Going back to the fact that you are opinionated, you have opinions about buffers, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And I haven't met many people in my life that are more opinionated than me, but one of them I need to give a shout out to is Nikolai, and I'm going to give it a crack, Samokvalov, who's my co-host on Postgres FM, and I think he might be even more opinionated than me, especially around the topic of buffers. And we've both in the past blogged about the benefits of using buffers, because it's not on by default when you use explain analyze. Lots of people use explain analyze without it, and it can really help people, not just in terms of spotting certain issues that you can't spot with timings alone, but also in understanding why something's slow. So I think a lot of people that use explain analyze, a lot of developers that haven't used it a lot before, can use it, spot that there's a sequential scan that's filtering out loads of rows, add an index, see that it's much faster, and get this feeling that it's magic. But if the inclusion of buffers will show them that they've gone from reading 6 gigabytes of data to reading, 24 kilobytes or something like that, and that suddenly it becomes extremely obvious that it's not magic, and it's purely about efficiency of reads. So yeah, that's why we both feel so strongly about it, and are just trying to encourage people, on a bit of a crusade, to encourage people to use it by default, not just individual developers, but also anybody creating training materials or writing blog posts or going on podcasts. So yeah, just trying to encourage people to spread the word and help people understand how database performance works, that it isn't magic, and that you can But by making things more efficient, we can make them a lot faster too.
So I first met you in person at PG de Paris earlier this year. I mean, I think we'd interacted online before then, and we follow each other. And I know that you've attended the live chat on Discord for previous podcast episodes, which I was so excited about. The first time you showed up, I was just thrilled. But we met in person in Paris, and you were there to give a lightning talk. And I'm going to drop the link into the chat. But your lightning talk, the title was Buffers by Default. So that's how I knew we had to talk about it today, because I'd just seen you give that talk. And so in the YouTube video I just dropped in, I think you're 6th on the list of lightning talks. And it was a 5-minute presentation where you make your case as to why buffers are so useful. Let's just back up a second. Like, what are buffers exactly? What does that mean to turn them on and explain? You told me the benefit just now, which is very compelling, extremely compelling. But what is it exactly that they are?
Yeah, so you will get extra statistics at each node in the... One thing I didn't explain well was that you'll get this plan, but it will be a kind of a tree structure. So you have the final operation will be the first one you see, and then that will show you any children operations that it spun up to execute the query. And that can go, and it's very tree-based, often in, you know, each parent having like one or two children, that kind of thing. And each level of that, so each node or each operation will report how long it took. But with buffers, you also get how much data was read as part of that subtree. So if you get all the way to the leaf nodes of this tree, you'll see each scan and how much, for example, how much data it read from Postgres's shared buffers, how much data it found that it read that it didn't find in the shared buffers. And it will report that in number of pages or number of blocks. And so you'll get like an integer number, maybe like 10,000. And each one of those is by default in Postgres, 8 kilobytes. So you know that that has read, 8 megabytes roughly of data to read 1,000 pages. So you do have to do these calculations if you're just reading raw explain output. But once people know that, they can keep an eye out, and it's much more intuitive to understand. Well, generally, it will correlate really well with what the slow parts of your query are and how many buffers they're having to read or write or whatever else.
Well, and it's interesting. You're continuing to focus, like you just talked about, how it's more intuitive to understand. That whole focus on simplicity, like, just keeps coming out in this conversation. It's whatever that word is, that German word for seeing something over and over again. I'm seeing that with you in simplicity. You had an episode of your Postgres FM podcast the other day. I think it was episode 94, if I remember correctly, and it was called Buffers to the Sequel. Because it wasn't the first time you had talked about buffers on your podcast with Nikolai. But there was something you said, one of you said in that episode that I really liked, which is that it's the best way to figure out if you're doing work faster or not doing the work at all. Did I get that right? Does that resonate? Or do you remember one of you saying that?
I could believe that we said something like that for sure. I don't remember which one. And I do remember a lot of good quotes about performance work along the lines of the fastest way of doing something is not having to do it at all. And so reducing the work, I'm a big fan of like less is more and all of those things. If we can be very precise in just the data we need, if we can look it up very precisely and not have to read anything else, that's going to be hugely more efficient. Not only database, not only server side, which is what we're looking at here, but also in terms of transmitting data over the wire to the client. The less work we can do, the better. And the kind of the extreme version of that is if we can avoid having to do it at all, then that's a win, right? And it's often one you don't consider, depending on where you come in to a problem. If you're the DBA or you're somebody that's been asked to help speed up a query, it does take you kind of a little bit of lateral thinking to step back and say, do we need to run this at all? You know, what? Why are we running this? Why are we running this, I don't know, 10,000 times an hour or whatever it ends up being? By asking those questions, you do sometimes get to a much better global situation than just by adding an index to make that 10,000 times an hour thing more efficient, faster. But if you could turn it in, if you don't have to run it at all, your database is going to be happier.
It's interesting, this whole focus on do we need to run it at all. It applies to other parts of life too, right?
Yeah,
so after you work in Postgres for a while, you start to see, and at least I start to see analogies everywhere. Like, I start to see the whole world as a resource management problem. So I think about even producing this podcast, and one of our producers, Ari Padilla, and I have conversations about, like, how can we improve the efficiency of our post-production workflow after we've done the live recording so that we have to do less work to get from that juncture to the published state. And anyway, so there's Postgres analogies everywhere.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so something else that you said that I thought was really interesting, and, you know, full disclosure, of course, I work for Microsoft, so my focus is primarily on doing things in the Postgres community, things that are open source focused, mm-hmm. community building focused. This podcast, I was on the talk selection team for Posette, an event for Postgres, which is this is going to be the third year of our virtual conference. And it's going to happen this year in June, June 11th through 13th. And I think Teresa, the chair, might have dropped the schedule in the chat a few minutes ago. So that's what I do. But I work for Microsoft. I get paid by Microsoft. I am located organizationally right connected next to the Azure Database for Postgres Managed Service team. You know, my boss is responsible for that line of business around Azure Database for Postgres. So you said this, and it really resonated given that, you know, the cloud pays my salary. You said, I do think we're in a new world with cloud providers now, where, for example, PGSAT statements is off by default in Postgres, but in many cloud providers, it's turned on by default, which means that for many users of Postgres, PGSAT statements is on by default. But those words resonated with me. I do think we're in a new world with cloud providers and how people consume Postgres, how they use it, how they run on it. I can definitely.
And I think there's another big thing at play that I didn't mention then, which is also how Postgres is being pushed forwards. And if you look at the list of committers, and Microsoft's a great example, you employ multiple committers, multiple people, and not just committers, but also other contributors and people that do a lot in the community, sponsor a load of events. But you're not the only ones, thankfully, and there are a lot of other large cloud providers also contributing, not just committers, but to the community and to events and to the education and to pushing Postgres forwards. And that looked very different 10 years ago. It wasn't so much hosting providers, it was much more consulting companies that were shouldering the large burden of that. And consulting companies also now provide managed services, but there's this really interesting history of bit like how Postgres has been effectively funded. And I don't necessarily just mean financially, but how it's been built, who's actually written the code, who's actually written the docs, who's contributed to this thing that we all use, love, and work with. The cloud providers are now a huge part of that, including Microsoft. So it is a really interesting new world from those two perspectives. Not just who's pushing it forwards, who's making it better, but also what's the experience like of the end user? So often in wherever you are online, if somebody says, I'm using Postgres and I've got this problem, they won't say, I'm using Postgres on RDS, I'm using Postgres on Azure, I'm using, you know, they won't tell you where they're using Postgres. They'll just say, I'm using Postgres. So they don't, in their head, they're not thinking, I'm using some slightly modified version of Postgres or some, they think they're using Postgres. So people's experience of what Postgres is slightly different now than it was. Well, I was going to say than it was 10 years ago. Of course, that's true. But it's not you're so much less likely to find somebody with default config or with no backups or with, you know, no HA setup, because a lot of these things are now done by default. And my example was pgstat statements, but there are all sorts of extensions that a lot of cloud providers are now choosing to turn on by default for people, or settings that they're tuning for people depending on the instance size and things. And there's a lot of advantages you have as a cloud provider. You know their box size, you know a lot about that customer. Maybe they've got spending limits in place, or they've got certain things that you know about them that Postgres core developers don't know about their customer, whoever's just installed it. So there's a ton of advantages there. And as a community, as people that, you know, if I make a tool, I was talking to Nikolai, he does consulting, he helps people out also with tools. And we have to then adapt, we have to think, what is the general experience? And it's not just people running self-hosted Postgres anymore, it is people running flavors of Postgres on all of these cloud providers. So I think it is slightly different.
So as you think about your people who come to PG Mustard for help with Explain, you also mm-hmm. have to think about people who are running in the cloud, right? And what do they need from PG Mustard? Is that fair?
Yeah. And also, what do they have access to? Like, can they use Auto Explain? Until last year, I think, Heroku didn't support. Well, Heroku, one of the earlier managed Postgres providers, didn't support Auto Explain, even though it comes as a contrib module. They do now. It's great. Most cloud providers do. But not that wasn't true even as recently as a year ago. So people not having access to install extensions is a big difference between managed Postgres and self-hosted Postgres. So it is a little bit kind of what are they likely to have set? What are their defaults? But also it moves the conversation a little bit from what do the core team have to worry about versus what should be handled outside of core. So one example might be, and it was kind of related to PG Mustard, is random page cost. So we talked about Postgres having a cost-based model for choosing choosing an optimal query plan. One of the most important factors there is the difference between, like, the cost model for how much a certain read will cost or how long it will take. And historically, a decent approximation was that a sequential read, so reading a table in order, page after page, would cost about four times less than doing a random read, more like that you get via an index scan. So reading pages not in order. However, that's not so true nowadays with SSDs. And a better approximation is that instead of it being four times more expensive, it might be in the order of 10 to 20% more expensive. So a lot of people are moving random page costs down to, instead of being four, being more like 1.1 or 1.2. So that can be changed on the Postgres side in core. I'd probably argue that there's a good argument for it, but it can also be changed by each cloud provider without core having to do anything.
I looked up before we started today whether pgstat statements was in fact turned on by default in Azure Database for Postgres, and the answer was it was, which means, yeah. And you probably knew that already. That's a really interesting example with random page cost. I love that you're chock full of examples.
Before I forget to ask though, Claire, we talked about everyone's experience with explain, and that first experience of sometimes it's like a wall of text. And I definitely had that experience, and I was a bit surprised when I was reading examples online where somebody would paste, what on earth, like, how do I make this faster? And within a few minutes they were getting help from somebody online, and, you know, just from reading the explain plan, they were able to say, add this index and it'll be fine. And the person goes, yeah, that worked great. Do you remember the first time you came across explain plans, or like first had to try and understand one?
I think for me, the first time I came across explain plans was in blog posts. Because that's one of the first things when I joined Citus that people leaned on me for, particularly because we were spread across 5 or 6 countries. And, you know, people with English as a second language, and, you know, engineers who were, well, most of them were brilliant, but they were used to speaking engineer to engineer. And when you write a blog, you are writing to other developers, but you're writing to a spectrum of potential users, right? Who might be expert in that particular topic or might not yet be expert in that topic. So your language needs to be really super clear, right? And it needs to be unambiguous. Right. Every time I'm like a stickler for not using words like it or this or that, because they stop a reader in their tracks to try to figure out, well, what is it? What are you referring to? Which of the three possibilities in the previous sentence might you be referring to? So anyway, the first explain plans I ever encountered were in my first couple of months at Citus, and it was in reviewing other people's blog posts, right, where they were putting them as examples in the blog. And so, you know, I had to figure out, what's an explain plan? Like, what does this do? Why is it formatted like this? How do I make it readable in the blog post itself? Because, you know, the results can be really wide, or they can, you know, line wrap funny if you don't code it right. That was my first experience. And given how prolific Craig Kirstein's used to be as a blogger, who knows, it was probably one of his blog posts. Because he wrote a lot of blogs. So.
Yeah, I used to love, I still love, but you definitely used to blog a lot more on the Citus blog, and I remember several amazing ones. I think we actually linked to one within our product. It's there was a one Citus did a blog post on fast accounting. It was amazing for anybody kind of that wants to look into count estimation methods and things. It's a really, really good post.
I'm going to go dig that up right now and see. Faster Postgres counting. That was written by Joe Nelson. Yeah, that blog post was written in 2016. And I can just tell you, I know this without going and looking at the analytics. It still gets a lot of page views and traffic, organic traffic, like people, it's still popular. So cool.
We still link to it. We think it's great. It's exceptional. Really well written, really thorough, and very, very, very helpful.
Yeah, Joe is an engineer's engineer. But he's also an exceptionally good writer and communicator, and actually did a lot of the Citus open source documentation too. I want to pivot a little bit and ask you a stylistic question. You know, when we promote this live recording and the podcast itself, then the title of this episode 15 is My Journey to Explaining Explain. You know, I paused for a second. Like, should the explain, the last word in that episode title, be capitalized? And what do you think? Should it have been? Because it's not. If you look at the graphic, everything is mixed case.
Yeah. And there is I think in chat, somebody linked to the wiki. And I think there's a slightly sarcastic comment saying, here's a list of talks and blog posts about explain. And then something like, most of which are called explaining explain. So it's I'm definitely in good company with in the bad jokes club. So I actually haven't used that title myself for anything before today, so thank you for knowing me, meaning I'm part of that club. But yeah, the capitals thing is kind of an age-old debate in SQL query writing, isn't it? I'm not dogmatic about this kind of thing. I think if in context people know exactly what you mean, it doesn't matter, and probably skew a little bit towards writing things lowercase where I can, because it's slightly less shouty. I'm definitely part of the generation that grew up with a lot of texting, and some generational differences on how much we used caps lock for everything.
Okay, so to you, all caps can mean shouting and yelling and being angry. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So, but I do use explain with capitals in a lot of things I do as well, when the context is important. So, for example, if it's something you're hoping Google will show, writing it in capitals helps people that are searching for that understand you are talking about the SQL keyword, not the English word, for example.
Right. That's right. In blog posts, I actually tend to like to capitalize it when I'm talking about the SQL keyword, because I find that it makes it pop a bit more in a good way. If you're looking for examples, if it just makes it clear that it's not just the regular English word that we're going to start talking SQL now. So
exactly.
I like the way it looks there.
Do you mean like within a paragraph? I completely agree. But
yes.
Then when we include like code snippets, I don't mind so much. Exactly. I said I was opinionated. Maybe I'm not so much about this one.
Well, here is something you are opinionated about. When I go to the Postgres documentation, I typically don't go there by like going to a bookmarked URL and then browsing my way to the relevant page. I'm a search person. I just go into the search box in my browser and I type in a few keywords. And I'd like to think I'm really good at search, because I generally will get what I want in one of the first few search results, click on it, and I'm there. But sometimes there, if I'm looking for a Postgres docs page, can end up being an older version of the doc, not the latest one, maybe a two-year-old version or something like that.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that there's like a little message at the top that says in like a yellow box or something. Maybe it's not yellow, whatever color it is, a colored box. And it says, you know, you were looking at an older version of this docs page. Would you like to go to the newest version? And then I can easily click to get current, to get to modern day. But we started somehow talking about this area, and you had some strong opinions about things that could have, would have, should have been done so that Google wouldn't serve me up an older version of the docs page. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, you're spot on. So this used to wind me up so much. Like back in 2018, 2019, when I was doing research around Postgres, learning about it, I'm definitely in the group of people that when they're trying to learn something, my search engine history is hundreds of pages long of, you know, what I've actually searched. So I would turn to search engines as pretty much my first port of call when I'm learning. And over again, I would look something up in Postgres, and then only halfway down reading the documentation, realize I'm reading an old page. So, you're quite right. If the version's out of support, you will get a yellow text box warning you at the top of the page. But if you happen to land on one of the versions, maybe 3-4 years out of date, so nowadays that would be what, like version 13, version 12, it's still in support, but it's not like it's also still 3 or 4 years old. And things can change in that time. Like things can go from being not true to true, or defaults can change. And it could be quite frustrating to have read all of that, like that entire page, without them realizing. So I'm pretty sure it happened to me quite a lot and I didn't realize, but it also happened to me a lot and I did realize. And there wasn't a great solution. I kept forgetting to include the latest version number in the search terms I was searching. So it would happen to me over and over again. And I eventually, I looked into what the problem was. And sadly, it had come up as a topic multiple times on the mailing list. And there were some people thought there were quite risky ways of addressing the problem. And it had kind of gone round and round in circles a few times, sadly. Lots of people looking out for good interests and not, you know, really good motives, not wanting to tank our brilliant, whatever you want to call it, SEO juice or whatever, for whatever reason, all the search engines ranking Postgres.org at the top of the results when you search for pretty much anything Postgres related. So it had done a great job over the years. The problem was these having multiple pages that were pretty much almost duplicates of each other. Google had to kind of fight spammers that would also do things like that, and they had to work out which is the real version of this, or what's the most authoritative version of this, what's the best version of this, or the original. And it has loads of different ways of doing that, but one way it does is it has a thing called you can tell Google that this is the canonical version of this page on this site. And it's a risky thing to do, but it has loads of benefits as well. And yeah, it had been discussed, but it hadn't been done. I eventually gave up hope that it was going to be fixed because it had come up so many times, and ended up making a browser extension just for myself. And I open sourced it and let other people use it. And in fact, I think that's one of the first ways me and Nikolai ended up speaking, because he was a user of that extension. I might be misremembering that, but he definitely used it. So yeah, made that little extension for myself and kind of forgot about the problem, or was kind of I'd given up hope, and I now had a solution. Whenever I clicked on a Stack Overflow link or Google search link or something that went to an old version, it would automatically redirect me to the latest version. And crucially, it had like some safety measures, like it wouldn't redirect if there wasn't a new version of that page, and it wouldn't redirect when you were on the Postgres docs as well. So if I did deliberately want to go to an old version, that was like the problem with, that's why I couldn't just use a generic redirection tool. So yeah, there's probably no need to do that, to use that extension anymore though. I still have it installed just because of some Stack Overflow posts. But luckily a few years ago, famous Microsoft employee, person of the year perhaps, Andreas Freund, re-brought this up. This was back in 2021. Brought up the problem again, and it went through a similar kind of... There was definitely like a lot of people that wanted to help solve it, Jonathan Katz included. A lot of people that... It was Jonathan that ended up making the change. But a lot of people chimed in, helped out, and it looked like it had kind of petered out again. So I was one of the people that chimed in and said, it'd be awesome, we've made this work. I'd learned a little bit about how Google in particular did search engine result placement, so it could link to a couple of things that might help people have a bit less fear on what the effect would be. And Jonathan made the change, they monitored it, and so these days if you search for most things Postgres related, so like, you know, syntax type things or information about a certain Postgres feature, chances are you're going to get linked to the version of the docs that have current in them, current, like the latest version of the docs. So that makes me really happy. I do still every now and again spot one that isn't, but we're getting there. It's almost all now, which is nice.
So did you uninstall your browser extension?
Not yet. So the one remaining issue is some old Stack Overflow posts linked to old versions. And I do every now and again, like somebody reported one recently. I can't remember which one. It was something like gist versus gin indexes. So if you search for that, some search engines will rank some really old version of the docs, maybe like 9.1 or something.
Okay.
And I think it's because there's a Stack Overflow post that has got a lot of views. Clearly people are interested in the differences between gin and gist indexes.
Of course.
That is then seen as by Google as a very good source of information about this. So they rank, even though the Postgres docs tell Google and other search engines that the canonical version is the current version, they're like, actually, we think this one's better. So I've submitted a little edit for that. I don't know if it's been accepted yet. I haven't checked. But so I'm trying to go back and edit the old pages and the old questions and answers in Stack Overflow to gradually improve it as well.
So for those of you listening online, we'll have a link to Michael's browser plugin, pg_docs_bot, the browser extension, in the show notes. But
yeah, sure. Let me know if you use it. It's a bit overdue an update, but it works.
Yeah, and I stand corrected. In my example, in the kickoff of this thread of the conversation, I talked about how you would get that yellow box if you were on an older version of Postgres Docs. But you're right. You're exactly correct. I was wrong. It's only when you're on an unsupported releases page that you get that yellow box. And then if I happen to be just one release back, but I'm looking for the current, it's very easy to be in the wrong place and not realize it. So I'm really glad that this change got made. What release was it that it was made in? The change you said Jonathan Katz ended up.
Well, it's the website, so it doesn't need to be like it's not coordinated with releases. But I think it was in March. I've got my notes here. In March 2022.
Okay.
It made a much faster impact than many people were expecting. Like within a few weeks, it was much, much, much better. But over the next few months and still now, I'm noticing some more pages flipping, which is nice.
Well, one of the things I really like in the Postgres world is that there is a big commitment to the documentation. I mean, I guess that's true in a lot of open source developer communities, right? Docs are important. And it would be nice if, you know, everything was so intuitive, you didn't need documentation, but that's not the reality of really complex system software yet. At least I don't think it is anywhere. So docs matter.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it depends. I think there's like a certain amount of, I do believe the same thing. I think a lot of user interfaces can be made so that they are self-explanatory, so you can use them. The information you need is available to you at the time that you need them, and you don't need to look things up. But platforms, things that you need to develop for, or interfaces that aren't graphical, I do think you need documentation. You need to have definite, what is something? What's the maximum something can be? What's the default when you don't specify it? So many things have to be documented and have to be accurate. I think accuracy in docs is underrated. I think we perhaps take that somewhat for granted with the Postgres docs because it's normally written. The documentation is normally written by the person who wrote the feature. In fact, patches off, like I see quite a few patch discussions where somebody's wondering why nobody's got back to them on a patch, or where nobody's reviewed something yet, or it hasn't been committed. Something some people bring up is, well, yeah, this doesn't even update the documentation yet, so it definitely can't be committed. So that it's really nice to see that level of commitment, that it's not just an addition to the product, it's part of the product. So yeah, I've got huge respect for them. And they're often cited as very, very good. They could definitely be more comprehensive in places. They're much more reference than guide style. They contain examples, but not loads of examples. Like, there's so many ways to make them better, and it's definitely an opportunity for people that are getting involved. Like, it's something I did. There's a great page on use and explain in the Postgres docs, but it's one page. There's only like a few examples in it. You can get really deep on how to use explain. And so it's very much only an introduction. It covers the beginning things you need to know very, very well, very, very clearly. But yeah, I've made a glossary of terms of all the things that I really wanted to know when I was building the tool, but also doing performance work generally. There's so many things that you have to look up, and that there weren't good reference materials for. So it's something that it's a bit of a maintenance nightmare as new versions come out, but I agree with you completely. Good documentation is worth so much, and it's so helpful when you need it.
So before we wrap up today, I am curious if you want to give a shout out to any of our listeners, to some of your favorite Postgres resources for learning. You already talked earlier about how your first port of call when you're doing learning is, you know, a search engine, and that you're searching for things that have been published on the internet or already exist out there. But I'm curious, are there any conferences, any websites, any books, anything in particular you want to point people to as a great way to learn more about Postgres? Oh, podcasts. Besides this podcast, of course.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends. Yeah, people learn in different ways, don't they? I think it's really fascinating. Conference-wise, should give a shout-out to CitusCon coming up.
Now called Pozette.
So sorry.
Do you know what Pozette stands for?
I'm going to say, I've read it. I've read your blog post, but I don't remember. Sorry.
That's totally okay. I mean, it's kind of inspired by FOSDEM. Most people only know with FOSDEM what the first few letters stand for, and then they kind of trail off and mumble for the last few letters. So it's an acronym that has become a name, you know what I mean? And so yes, that's the vision for Pozette, an event for Postgres too. I'll just tell you what it stands for. Postgres Open Source Ecosystem Talks, Training, and Education. So, yes. But no one is expected to remember that ever. So, okay. So there's your shout out for Pozette, which I was not fishing for, but I thank you for it. Because I'm very excited about it.
I've just realized you have to spell it all caps then, don't you?
Yes,
so
we do.
So maybe you have to shout it when you say it.
Well, when we use the hashtag online, it's PozetteConf, all one word. And we do the camel case or the Pascal case thing for that for accessibility reasons, right? To make it easier for people to read. Because when it's all lowercase, you know, things get hard to read.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry, okay. I'm conscious of time. I'm going to give you a few resources. Sorry, I didn't answer that properly.
It's okay.
On Learning Explain, I found a video by Josh Berkus, exceptional, called Explain Explained, unsurprisingly. But so much so that I've never tried to give a similar talk. I've only ever tried to give talks that are the beginner, like the bit before that or the bit after, kind of like explain beyond the basics. I think that talk is so good and point people to it all the time. Additionally, there's an old blog post by ThoughtBot about reading, explain, analyze that I think is exceptional. Depeche, who makes arguably the original tool for reading, explain, analyze, output, and an excellent tool, explain.depeche, has also a series on explaining the unexplainable that's really good. Dalibo have a great tool as well for reading explain plans, explain.dalibo. Those two are open source and great community members, like fellow sponsors at the Dalibo was fellow sponsors at the recent event we met at, weren't they? So
DJ
yeah,
Dave Harris, yes.
Yes. So in addition to those, I really like Planet Postgres. It's a great blog aggregation community initiative.
I love Planet Postgres. And for any of you listening who blog about Postgres, you can register your blog. It's not just anybody who publishes on your blog. Every registration is a combination of the blog and the author, right? So each individual author on a particular blog has to register, but you can register. And then effectively, whenever you publish a blog, it'll get picked up and syndicated by Planet Postgres. So it gets tweeted out to a lot of followers, and there's an RSS feed for Planet Postgres as well. And you know, there's policies. Right? It can't be just an advertisement for some commercial technology. It's got to have a big open source focus. But really great way to just keep track of, you know, all the people publishing a lot of different Postgres things from all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to those, things that it won't pick up are things like Postgres Weekly, which is an excellent newsletter.
Peter Cooper is a favorite. He's wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, they do an excellent job of aggregating the weekly Postgres-related news. One of the highest compliments I ever got about our PG Mustard newsletter was that it basically we're the second. They considered us the second best newsletter after Postgres Weekly, which I was chuffed about. And in addition to that, something else that won't get picked up by Planet Postgres is Lucas Fittle, who's previous guest of this show, does an excellent YouTube series on 5 minutes of Postgres. So taking often something that was covered by Planet Postgres, but going into a bit more detail or tying three or four things together and explaining it really well and in quite deep. Well, considering it's 5 minutes, in quite a lot of depth, does a great job.
Yeah, and he does this weekly or even more frequently than that.
I think I'm pretty sure it's weekly.
I'm looking right now, and I can drop the link in. His most recent episode, he's done 112 of these so far. So he's done more 5 minutes of Postgres than you have your Postgres FM episodes. I'm just saying. But he puts the biopics on the cover slide or the YouTube thumbnail for the people whose work he's talking about, right? Whose work he is dissecting in a particular episode. And so I'm looking at the friendly faces of Thomas Monroe and Melanie Plagman and Bilal Yavuz and Andres Freund. So it's all about streaming IO, which is a new, big, exciting thing that's going to be coming out in Postgres 17, we think.
Yes.
And I say we think I can't imagine why or how it could ever be backed out. But Postgres 17 is kind of in the end game of its development, right? So the code freeze happened, and then we're gonna, you know, obviously end up with beta releases that come out over the summer, and then it will GA in the fall. So
yeah, cool. Exactly. If like a showstopper bug is found that can't be fixed easily or that has other ramifications, sure, like things could still get reverted, but there've already been a few reverts. So I think things that are still in at this point are a little bit safer.
Okay. Any other pointers for people new to Postgres or who want to learn more?
I mean,
you've given a lot. So
I could keep talking forever on this stuff. It's like stuff I love. But yeah, podcast wise, we'd love to have you on ours, but also there are, like, I listen to every Postgres podcast. So if anybody wants to start a new one, you can count me as a new listener. Scaling Postgres has been going way longer than like a few hundred episodes. It also does a roundup of the news if you prefer an audio version of that. And yeah, there's more as well. But yeah, I really like podcasts as a medium for learning. So thank you for doing this. I've learned a lot from these episodes, and you've had some wonderful guests on. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I feel honored that you're here and that we have had such wonderful guests as well on the other episodes. And I think we have guests scheduled for the next four or five months. So, like, we're starting to book up. It's really kind of exciting. And ours is, of course, only monthly. So to be at episode 15 is also kind of exciting. I am so glad that we sat on the stairs for an hour and a half and caught up in Paris and agreed to do this episode together. I want to thank you, Michael Christofides, for joining us. And
thank you so much, Claire.
The next episode of the Path to CitusCon podcast will be recorded live on June 19th. At 10 a.m. PDT. Now you might say, wait a minute, June 19th, that's not the first or second Wednesday in the month. What's going on? But in June, the POSET, an event for Postgres virtual conference, is happening. So our team will be a little bit distracted those first couple of weeks of June. So we're pushing out. And our guests will be Teresa Giacomini and Aaron Wisling. And they're going to be talking about dishing on POSET. And Postgres is what I have as the title. But somebody else is trying to negotiate with me to change it to the making of POSET, an event for Postgres. Which title do you like better, Michael? I'm curious.
Say them both again.
Dishing on POSET in Postgres or the making of POSET, an event for Postgres?
Nikolai and I argue about titles all the time. I always err on the side of say what it does, like, which is more the latter, right? But then yeah, dishing, it sounds a little bit more gossipy and a little mad.
Maybe a bit more fun.
Yeah, so Nikolai's more fun. I'm more say it as it is.
Okay. Well, mark your calendar if you're interested in joining that one so that you don't get double booked. The short URL to mark your calendar is aka.ms/path2cytoscon, all one word, -EP16-CAL. And you can get to past episodes and get links to all of the podcast platforms you can subscribe to at aka.ms/path2cytoscon, all one word. And transcripts are included on the episode pages for all past episodes on Transistor 2. Now, before we leave, if any of you have enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. It helps other people find the new show. And you can also post a public compliment on your favorite social media platform if you do the social media thing on Twitter, Mastodon, LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera. And a big thank you to everybody who joined the recording live here on Discord. And we really appreciate your presence and your questions and all your participation in the live text chat. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Ciao, ciao.